From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn about a new initiative to give mental health services to members of the Milwaukee Fire Department. Then we'll visit one of Milwaukee's longest-standing Mexican bars and learn how they toast their patrons.
It means a lot when we see different faces, different cultures, different generations come in. They're here to support us. And, you know, we can't treat them, we treat them con amor.
Plus, we'll speak with the co-writer of The People's Joker, a viral film that centers queer experiences.
The specific becomes universal. So the more specific we got, the more Vera was willing to give of her own life, the more that we're finding, like, myself, for sure, and then also people watching the movie really find a lot to relate to.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll get a slice of life from one of Milwaukee's oldest Mexican bars and learn how they celebrated Cinco de Mayo this past weekend. We'll start with this. This month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine features a profile of Milwaukee Fire Chief Aaron Lipsky and the challenges the fire department is grappling with. Lipsky says staffing shortages are leaving firefighters overworked and exhausted, as stations are responding to an unprecedented number of emergency calls. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Lipsky about what the fire department is doing to help address those issues, including the recent rollout of a new mental health initiative.
Many people aren't as aware of, they're becoming more aware. In our city, we do all of the emergency medical services work. So paramedic work for injuries, illnesses, anything that happens to somebody that's bad, we get called for. And I think most people would be unaware of what it means to do firefighting on one call, and then you're barely like got your wits about you from wrapping up from that, and boom, all of a sudden you're on an emergency medical call. You just bounce around all day, and it is extremely busy nowadays compared to any point in our history. It's the busiest. And that emergency medical work comes with, certainly you have to have the stomach for it, because you see and experience things that your brain can't imagine prior to actually seeing these things for the first time. And you move past that pretty quick because you fall back on your training and you realize standing there kind of in shock at what you're looking at is not helping. Mm-hmm. So you get very clinical about it, and you can get a little bit robotic and sterile about it, which that can be off-putting to people who don't understand what's going on, but it is actually the fastest way to get the care to the patient is to remove the emotion and the spectacle of it. The flip side of that, of course, is after repeated exposure, especially with the violent crime and the car wrecks and the overdoses and the nasty things people do to each other, the repeated exposure to that can harden you and make you cynical, and you can start to feel as if this is just how humanity is. And we do our best to remind people, you're not witnessing humanity in general. You're witnessing inhumanity in its most specific, horrible moments. And the two can't necessarily be compared directly to one another. And not every call is this huge traumatic event, but enough of them are that you really don't know what you're walking into. So the net result of that is you have to keep your readiness like pinged to 10 all day, all night, because you just never know what's about to happen.
That's exhausting.
It is beyond exhausting.
You really are witnessing someone's, like, the worst day of their life when you're going out to help them. But how does Fire Academy training prepare anyone for that?
So we have psychological evaluations pre-hire. The screen can be too tight on those sometimes. And in other times, it, the absence of one, folks can come through that maybe they're not suited for this. The wording on that, as we're coming to learn right now, is resiliency, both physical and psychological, emotional resiliency. How do you intersect with something that can take you off your center And how do you get back to that and move on and not carry that around now forever? And we are just starting in the fire service, perhaps in society in general, but definitely in the fire service. We are just starting to grapple with how do we do that? Because we've spent our whole time just go.
It.
And it's a badge of honor, right? To go and just take it and just be ready for the next one and then come back the next shift and do it all over again. And it's a badge of honor historically. So there's a cultural shift that needs to occur as well, that it's okay for you as the caregiver, the first responder, it's okay for you to be healthy as well. And we've missed that, I think, for a very, very long time, perhaps since the fire department was a thing and EMS was a thing. We've missed that part, caring for the first responder. And we are just wrapping our arms around some of that right now. And I think it'll be a good thing for everybody. I really, really believe if we take care of our own, and not in the shady sense of that, but really take care of the people that we're charged with taking care of, when they go out the door, they'll take better care of everybody else who's calling 911 for help. Because I think it does feed forward.
Right. And I know since this feature came out just recently, you announced that the Milwaukee Fire Department is working with Ignite the Spirit Milwaukee to help provide mental health services to all firefighters. Can you tell me more about this program?
Absolutely. So we have a little bit of distrust in the fire service, a little bit of distrust that if I go in and I have an issue, that somehow that works its way back through insurance to your employer, or that somehow that is a mark on your record. And so it's a paradox, right? Because we are really encouraging people to reach out for help now. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, people are afraid to reach out for help because if that ends up on their record, there's a belief that could impact future employment, future workplace comfort, really. Mm-hmm. And we try very hard and we succeed. When you're dealing with our peer support team or the employee assistance program, it is all confidential. I don't even know. I'm the chief of the fire department. I literally don't know who's engaging with any of the above. That's by design. But Ignite the Spirit Milwaukee is a nonprofit organization started by Joe Flick. He's a lieutenant on the Milwaukee Fire Department. And the whole goal of it was that when our members hit crisis, we need an immediate backstop to help. For instance, suffers a horrific loss in their family, typically unexpected, or maybe an illness involving a child, something where it just is going to take someone and put them on their heels for a while. How do we support that person right now? And not with a formal application and a review process and submit it and we'll get back to you in 6 months. Right now, what can we do? This can include covering funeral expenses, which I've seen them do. This could include food preparation, delivery, lawn service. This can include covering someone's transportation to get to inpatient care and a whole bunch of other things that I'm failing to mention just based on my memory here, but really, really has been a very, very good thing. There are no bills because Ignite the Spirit is covering the cost. So they can go and they don't have to have anything ever appear on the record. And if that gets us even one or two or three, people are already engaging. We'll never know who, we'll never know what. If it gets that last remaining few who have that concern to that assistance, this is going to be worth its weight in gold.
In addition to this program, what else do you think needs to happen to attract and retain new firefighters? Because I know in the feature, it talks a little bit about how in recent years, really since COVID, there's been a lot of retirements and there's been a lot of people who just leave. So what else needs to happen to bring people in and keep them there?
Oh, great question. And if I can give you a silver bullet answer, I could go on the talk circuit and make millions of dollars. because the entire fire service is grappling with this right now. But for us here, we've done a few things to try to be more proactive about it. The first thing is, it goes back to something we talked about before. You've got to treat your employees properly. And I don't just mean being a swell guy when you walk past and you talk with them. I mean, structurally, you have to treat your employees properly. You have to hire employees that are capable of doing the job, mm-hmm. give them the tools, train them, hold them to a standard, help them when they falter. But structurally, you have to hire enough employees to avoid what we've been doing for a couple of years here, which is the workload has been so over the top and we haven't had enough employees. And I don't want to blame COVID as the sole reason for it, but that had a huge impact that kind of set us back. We've been mandating our firefighters and paramedics at a pace that probably in 1 year exceeds the rest of the history of the fire department. And what this means is you thought you were going home at 8 a.m. in the morning at the end of your shift, but guess what? I got to fill the seats on the rig and I don't have enough folks volunteering to take the overtime shifts. So you're working today. For the full 24-hour shift, we did this thousands and thousands of times in the past couple of years. And that is pushing people who thought they were on a 53-hour work week, all of a sudden can be on a 70 or 80-hour work week. And it just keeps going because I have to fill the seats. We have a necessary minimum staffing requirement, but it puts all the pressure down onto the same spot all the rest of the pressure goes to the worker who's thought they signed up and were working a 53-hour job, and they're just being crushed. This is not unique to the city of Milwaukee, so it begs your question, what can we do to improve this? And we need to advocate as fire service leaders for proper staffing, running things threadbare in the pursuit of the myth of efficiency. It does not account for societal changes. And we're absorbing all those societal changes right now with dramatic increase in both EMS and firework. Mm-hmm. We have to properly staff for that. We have good support here in the city of Milwaukee and the county and working with strong partners in the state of Wisconsin. We finally have arrived at a spot where we're not going to be butchering this fire department. In fact, we're adding back. That's been an enormous wind in the sail for our firefighters. Just the knowledge that their support there has been remarkable to see.
Well, Chief Lipsky, thank you so much for speaking with me today. I really appreciate you taking the time to come out and talk to me.
Thank you for having me. I had a great time.
Aaron Lipsky is the fire chief for the Milwaukee Fire Department. He spoke with Lake Effect's Excrit Nunez. You can find the feature about Lipsky and the state of the fire department in this month's issue of Milwaukee Magazine. In about 15 minutes, we'll speak with the co-writer of The People's Joker about how the absurd and bold coming-of-age superhero parody reimagines one of Batman's best-known villains. But first, we'll get a snapshot of Cinco de Mayo celebrations at one of Milwaukee's oldest Mexican bars. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. This past Sunday, Milwaukee celebrated Cinco de Mayo, which honors Mexico's victory at the Battle of Puebla over French forces. Around the city, many places celebrated the day, including one of the longest-standing Mexican bars in the city, Camacho's. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez visited the bar on Cinco de Mayo to take in their traditions.
Cinco de Mayo is an interesting day in Milwaukee. On the south side, it means corridos and banda music floating through the air triumphantly. Mexican flags draped from cars and pickup trucks sporting decals of different regions of Mexico. It means that you don't have to walk too far until someone offers you a plate and a beer. But it's also a day where the culture can feel like a costume, a day where people drink margaritas without knowing what they're celebrating. And I love margaritas. And all the neighborhoods in Milwaukee, it's Walker's Point where I feel this contrast the sharpest. A multi-generational Latino neighborhood that has never called itself Walker's Point before recent development or gentrification. An area that's sprouting condos like spring tulips. A place where people selling marked up vintage clothes next to food trucks serving sushi burritos sits across the street from one of the oldest Mexican bars in the city. A bar that wears steel security bars under its blue awning and across its windows and doors like a rosary. A reminder of what the neighborhood still is. And a bar that celebrates Cinco de Mayo the same way it's been doing for the last 40 years.
Coming to you live from Camacho.
If the exterior of Camacho's is tough, the inside is anything but.
Like, anybody's welcome here, you know what I'm saying? So that's why he's doing so good. Because now we're getting all the new generation, and the people that are living around here in the apartments are coming to check it out. Like, oh, man, this is nice. And it's cheap beer, cheap liquor, cheap drinks. You're not downtown. You're not spending $10 a shot. You're spending $3 a shot down here. You know, like, come on. We got to keep these places running. You know what I'm saying? These mom-and-pop places are some of the best places and probably some of the best food. Yeah, it's on styrofoam plates. We ain't getting no nice, beautiful plates from downtown. But the food is amazing.
It didn't take long from the time I walked in until I was handed green and red beads and a full plate.
It wasn't nothing advertised. This is something that I normally do, you know, holidays, football games. What I do is I just provide free food to our customers, our regular customers.
What do you have today?
Today we have rice, beans, that is pork tacos, guacamole, salsa out there.
Wilda Maldonado is basically the matriarch around here. A job she inherited when she started dating and then got engaged to the bar's owner, Jesse Camacho.
You know, we have people that are across the street and they come in and they said, wow, I didn't expect to see this, or I didn't expect, you know, what I'm seeing. What were they expecting is a question.
All afternoon, people streamed into the bar from Zocalo, the trendy food truck park across the street. For most, it was their first time in the bar. It was a mix of young blood and long-time regulars, people who have inherited Camacho's like a family heirloom, and they all had stories to share.
When I was a kid, 8, 9 years old, we had to come get my uncle out of here because he'd be on the weekends, and my aunt would be like, go get your uncle. We had to come over here and go get him because he was a little bit drinking too much. So a Friday and Saturday night, go get him. We had to walk over here. Come on, Theo, let's go. We got to go home. Theo's waiting for you. We had to go get him.
You knew it was this place? Because there was a couple places.
No, we knew it was this place because this was a spot back in the day. And I'm telling you, when I say it's a Mexican Cheers, it's always been like this. How you seeing it now, same way.
Tomas Yoriegas was shooting pool when I came in, and he doesn't live in the neighborhood anymore, but he still calls Camacho's his neighborhood bar. And he pointed out a bunch of people I should talk to.
You too.
No, don't talk to
her.
Don't talk to me. I'll say some inappropriate.
This is Diana, and she did. Tomas and Diana grew up in the neighborhood together. And 5 years ago, they reconnected. Mm-hmm.
So she found her dream love, and, you know, that's it.
Ever. Whatever. Make sure you edit that out, okay?
Turns out Diana and I both snuck into the same bar in the area when we were underage. Acapulco.
It was like Acapulco, and then it was Sabina's. So I think I was at Sabina's before Acapulco. And Sabina's had both sides. It was like the restaurant and then the dancing side. So I always remember my godfather, who I used to come looking here for at Camacho's, would take me to Sabina's. And then I would eat there, and then we could go onto the other side and hear the music. But I knew to find him here Monday through Friday.
What makes a bar is the crowd. And that crowd is dependent on the bartender. So if you don't have a quality bartender, the crowd stops coming. And for the last 40 years, Camacho's has had some of the best bartenders in the neighborhood. Jesse Camacho runs the bar today, but his dad Daniel started it in 1983. You can tell by the no-nonsense on Jesse's face that today he is working. But for longtime patrons like Mary Marino Schmidt, she knows
a
different side.
Because he reminds me of his father. If you look at his father's picture and Jesse, they resemble. Jesse really resembles his father. So I love Jesse. We're very, very close. And when I take off by myself, you know, he'll always walk me to my car. All the time. He just takes care of me. So, yeah, that's why I like coming here. Believe it or not, he does smile.
ask around about Jesse, and everyone has a story. Here's Tomas again.
That Jesse's like that uncle you never had. Like, he's always going to, like, just be that guy. Like, he's awesome. Like, he's that guy since we were kids. His dad was the same way. His dad took care of all the people that are around him, made sure everybody, someone gets here drunk, someone's getting the ride home. Someone's taking an Uber. He ain't going to let nobody walk out of here in the bag. Like, okay, you're going to get a DUI, you're going to get hit by a car, it ain't going to happen. You know? I mean, that's the type of place it is. Like, it's not, you don't got nothing to worry about, you know? I wasn't having a good night one evening. I came in kind of down, and I didn't pay for any drinks. He's like, I got you. And I was here for like 3 or 4 hours.
And while everyone here has a story, some people know him even deeper, like his niece, Kika Mraz.
He was always like my really crabby uncle who would like, if we were making too much noise during the day, he'd get really frustrated with us and scold us for being loud. And then he'd be really playful and like pick us up out of whatever activity we were doing and go like pretend to flurry us in the toilet.
Kika remembers the bar before Jesse took it over when her grandpa was still alive. She says he was bartending at a place called 601, a bar on the corner of 6th and National. That's when Camacho's, previously called Shangri-La, went up for sale. And it was Daniel's dream to own a bar.
My grandpa was a really sweet guy. He established the bar, and my grandma would babysit us during the day. We lived next door to my grandparents, and then the bar is just down the block. So my grandma would babysit us, and she would also cook on the weekends for the clients. So just like you see food here. And back behind the bar, so there's the kitchen, and there was also a little crib that they would keep back there because my grandma would babysit us. So she would cook, keep us there entertained, and then she'd serve food to clients. And it was just, I don't know, that was my grandpa. Like, he was a bartender, but it was also where we would come and hang out with my grandparents a lot of the time. He would give us free chips and soda and gum. And you know, he'll have us do a couple of things like clean up the dust off of the bottles as kids. And that was just, it just felt so normal. Like, it never felt like the bar was a place of, I don't know, things that were inappropriate for kids. It was just the place where my grandpa was and when we would come and visit him.
Today, there's a mural on the side of the building of her grandpa, Daniel. He's got that same worn look in his eyes as his son, Jesse, almost looking over the neighborhood as it changes.
Like I said, I grew up on 4th and Washington, so it was like, I remember Acapulco. I remember, like, now how it is, it's so different, way different. And I feel like you said, like, a lot of this stuff is missing. It kind of gets overlooked with how much it's come up now. And it, you know, so it's like for us to come back here, we feel back at home. We feel, you know, like I said, I brought my friend for the first time. We brought my dad's girlfriend for the first time. Like, this is where we're from. Like, this is what we do. You know, it's a staple here for us. It's like a family establishment, you know. So it's nice it's still here. You know, it's nice that we can still come and, you know, keep Jesse young and on his toes.
It means a lot. It means a lot when we see different faces, different cultures, different generations come in. It, you know, they're here to support us. And, you know, we can't treat them. We treat them con amor. You know, that's all, you know, we could do. You know, hopefully we can keep on going for generations on end.
Like, having 5 bars a block from your house is maybe not like something that everyone experiences in their childhood neighborhood growing up. But for me, that was just where I grew up, and I never felt negatively or badly about my neighborhood. I always have embraced it, and I've always loved my neighborhood. It's changed a lot over the years. It's definitely, like, super hip now. Like, no one knew Walker's Point for anything before. I didn't even know it was called Walker's Point. I just know we were on Pierce, off the National.
Like, it was just like this space that existed. Yeah, like, is it still the South Side? It's still the South Side.
It's the South Side. There was these signs that said Walker's Point, but no one ever, like, cared to point out that we lived in Walker's Point. Suddenly it became cool, though, and now everyone likes being here, which I appreciate. I'm like, yeah, it's always been a cool place to be. Unfortunately, that also means that a lot of people have been priced out of being here. And that's why I feel so connected to Camacho's. I feel like it's a very grounding place for the neighborhood. And it brings in people who've been here forever. It brings in new people. And it's a really good reminder of the history of the area, with like the billiards, the plaque and everything, and all of the history that's behind the bar. I don't know. I feel like it brings a big sense of nostalgia and grounding for the neighborhood.
That was produced by Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. You can find more about Camacho's over at WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll speak with the co-writer of the viral yet elusive cult hit film, The People's Joker. Keep listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The People's Joker was released at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2022. It's since become an elusive yet viral sensation until its recent wider theatrical release. This crowdsourced movie is heavily based on the director, co-writer, and lead actor Vera Drew's life and relationship with queerness and comedy. It's co-written by Milwaukee native Brie LaRose. And ahead of a screening at Cactus Club, she joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the film.
Watching this, I honestly was like, where do I even start? Like, when I knew I'd have this conversation with you. In a good way, in the best way, I assure you. So we'll just start from the beginning. Like, where did the concept for The People's Joker even start?
Oh, that's a great story. It started in 2020, right before COVID lockdown began. Around that time, Todd Phillips, the director of Joker 2019, was talking about how he shifted to drama from comedy because you can't make comedy anymore because of cancel culture. And we, myself and my co-writer and the director of the film, Vera Drew, thought that that was stupid to say.
Yeah.
Did not agree with that as two people who've been making comedy for 10 years now and who haven't had half of the chances that people like Todd Phillips, who directed The Hangover, have had. So we were sort of clowning on him, as you do on Twitter.com.
Yep.
And Vera and I had known each other from work. We were working at Tim and Eric's production company, Absolutely. And Vera was primarily an editor at that time. I was writing on some of the projects they were producing. And I told Vera that the only way I would watch Joker 2019 was if she did sort of like a fart re-edit of it.
I love it.
Like a goofball alt comedy style, Tim and Eric style recut of the actual movie. So she started doing that. And then quickly realized that she actually wanted to make a whole new Joker movie about her experience as a trans woman in comedy and asked if I would help her write it. So we just sort of dove in and then, we took the joke way too far and here we are.
Here we are. I mean, I love the commitment and the follow through. And this film is described as a transgressive work of dark comedy, which I love. So can you share more about that term and what it means to you?
Yeah, I mean, dark comedy is like a very Midwestern sensibility when you think about it, right? Like, oh, I can't talk about the hard things, so let me joke about them, and then no one will look too closely. So that's sort of where we were coming from. Vera's from the Midwest as well. I'm from Racine originally, and she's from Illinois. So we were just both coming from like, oh, we have all these decades of trauma as queer people who didn't realize all the ways in which we were queer until much later in life. Let's unpack it and be really... sort of rude.
Rude, hyperbolic, slap you in the face.
Absolutely,
with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and from what I understand, you didn't really know much about Batman when you got these pages from Vera, right?
No, and I still don't.
Okay, but while people might think this is a disadvantage, I want to know how you think it was an advantage to you and played a strength to your writing partnership.
It was so fun to work with Vera because Vera has a deep, deep, deep love and a deep knowledge of the Batman universe. And so she, from the very beginning, was like, you don't need to know any of this.
you don't even need, I still haven't seen the original Joker because she never finished the recut. So,
yeah.
But it was beautiful. I mean, I write coming of age primarily. That's my favorite genre, always has been. And everything I write, even when I try to make it about adult problems, it's still very youthful. And so it was really like looking at the essential pieces of the story we were trying to tell and being able to hang the whole story on a very relatable, very universal, honestly, experience of figuring out who you are and having the courage to live as that. And then Vera was able to go in and find all, like a million touch points in the Batman universe to sort of pepper throughout. So it really is both. And it was so fun to have completely different sensibilities with someone you're working on a creative project with.
And with such a creative project being tied to Vera's own life, it's a semi-autobiographical queer trans coming of age story. So with your role as co-writer, can you share more of kind of the things you did with Vera, granted that it's based and inspired by her story? How did you feel coming into that, or what was your dynamic working to make sure that it was told the best way?
Yeah, it was supernatural. There were only a couple of things that we disagreed on what pieces to use, but otherwise it was, we knew from the beginning, okay, we're telling your story, I'm going to default to you. And I found her story super relatable. You know, we had a lot of things in common. I didn't realize I was gay until I was 29, and that's around the time that Vera was coming out as trans as well. And that's around the time that we became friends. So in talking about what that experience was like and what our memories of our gay childhoods, something queer listeners will, I'm sure, relate to, is something really fun about coming out is looking back at all of the things you did that were super gay when you were a kid that you missed. With the benefit of hindsight, seem very obvious. So we had a lot of early conversations where we were just sharing stories. And something we've been talking about a lot in the time since the movie's been able to be shared is that the specific becomes universal. So the more specific we got, the more Vera was willing to give of her own life, the more that we're finding, like myself for sure, and then also people watching the movie really find a lot to relate to. So really a sort of healing experience for both of us, I think.
Now, when it came to the rollout, that was not as smooth, shall we
say.
There is a legal disclaimer at the beginning of the film, and I have a feeling this wasn't in your first version, right?
No.
So for people who are unfamiliar, can you share some of the trials that this film has been on before finally, currently, really, being more widely available to non-film festival secret screening audiences?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I didn't really think the movie would ever be made.
So you just went for it, right?
Yeah. You know, it was COVID and we were just sort of having fun with our friends and expecting to share it with our friends and with our creative communities. And then we got very lucky, and amazing film programmer and lover of film, Peter Kaplowski, who works at the Toronto Film Festival. He saw the movie and he loved it. And he was the first one to want to bring it to Toronto Film Festival in 2022 for their Midnight Madness programming. So it's crazy horror movies, crazy comedy movies, the Midnight movies. And we were psyched to be there. We thought that surely there was some kind of mistake. And we're just sort of wandering around, like, how did we get here? And then the night before we were supposed to premiere, we got a letter from Warner Brothers that was not a formal cease and desist, but was a letter sort of stating that they disagreed, that it was covered under fair use and parody law, which we've had lawyers from the very beginning. Vera was very smart. As soon as she knew she wanted to do a Joker parody, she started seeking counsel to make sure she could do that legally, and followed that through the letter of the law every step of the way. But, you know, sort of three gay people versus a $1 billion
corporation.
It's like, it kind of presents some complications. So we did have to pull after one screening at TIFF. And then the you know, year and a half in between was just figuring out what to do next. So like you said, we did some secret screenings, we did some festival screenings, and then we were so lucky to find Frank Jaffe at Altered Innocence, who's our distributor. They distribute amazing queer movies, art house films, restorations, and Frank just loved the film and he took a chance on it and said, I agree that this movie is fully covered under parody law, and I also feel it's really important to take the risk and just put it out there so that people can actually see it and find other people in the audience who want to see it. So we owe this like very beautiful theatrical run to Frank Jaffe and Altered Innocence.
And recognizing how hard that period was for you and Vera, and I'm sure all the people involved in this project, coming on the other side now, do you feel like this elusive journey to cult hit is a type of badge of honor now that adds to
the
whole sensibility of the movie to begin with?
Totally. It just, and it's also like kind of the plot of the movie, which is pretty funny. So, you know, for me, I've just been along for the ride, you know, just sort of surprised and amazed and delighted and what's going on. But, you know, Vera took out a personal loan to finance this movie, and she spent years of her life making it. She edited the entire thing, did a ton of VFX. She stars in it, you know, so it's blood, sweat and tears of hers that went into the film. So really, it's been beautiful to see my friend be able to share something that she poured so much of herself into. And to have it received, because it has been, it's been a long and winding road.
Definitely. And in addition to poking fun at Batman, the superhero genres in general, there's also obvious hits to the whole system and idea of comedy gatekeeping, which I found really funny, especially with your and Vera's background. So, you know, you're a writer, producer, you've done stand-up, and you've taken classes at UCB. And I want to know, like, what was the best part of blatantly pointing out the flaws of the comedy system you're trying to get into and be a part of?
I mean, it's just fun to sort of be a little rascal.
Yeah.
But I think about it a lot as, like, you know, there's this whole idea in comedy of punching up and punching down, and a lot of the criticism for these massive comedians like the Dave Chappelle's of the world punching down on, you know, trans communities and other communities who have been a punching bag their entire existence. And what's funny about punching down? So I think this whole, like, taking on the comedy industry as a whole feels very, to me, like punching up. You know, Lorne Michaels is the villain of our show.
I love Maria Bamford as the voice of Lorne Michaels.
Yes.
Like, that is my favorite thing, I have to tell you.
Yeah, it's awesome. She's the best.
Yeah.
She's an angel.
How did she get involved? Was it just an ask from you?
Yeah, Maria has been an angel in my career since the very beginning. She gave me my first opportunity when I was a production assistant, like getting lunches for the writers on her show. She gave me an opportunity to open for her doing stand-up, and then that's sort of what led me to starting to get actual writing jobs. But she's just like a Midwestern princess, you know?
Yes.
Like, she's just the best and has a very generous creative spirit and really looks for opportunities to, you know, extend a hand behind her instead of pulling the ladder up. So Maria has been a part of my professional life since I've had a professional life. And so when we were thinking about who we could have step in and voice CGI Lorne Michaels, we thought,
so WB took
Maria
issue, but has Lorne taken issue?
We haven't heard.
That's
we haven't
great.
Heard anything. So, you know, it's all in good fun.
You can
fun.
Send Maria to him. So there's so much that has gone into this, and it's clear, you know, watching every single frame. But for you, what will you always remember or take away from your experience co-writing an illegal comic book movie, as it's been called?
Well, two things. First, a sort of magic happens when you make art just to make it without thinking, oh, I'm going to sell this. Oh, this is going to get me an amazing job. Oh, the studios are going to love this. You know, like from the very beginning, we knew this was just for us. So we did whatever we wanted, and we weren't really having these sort of practical questions that get in the way of a creative process. And that was so freeing and so satisfying and so affirming just from, you know, having an artistic voice and having things to say and what I think is funny and trusting that instead of trying to fit it into a box of what's already working, what's already selling, what's already people are buzzing about. You know, this movie's very much not that. And then the second thing has really just been this the last month or so since the rollout, the theatrical rollout. A couple weeks ago, we premiered in Chicago at the Music Box Theater, and we sold out two nights, which was amazing. And those audiences were largely trans and queer audiences. And the feeling of sitting with our community and having this story to share was so incredible. Like, I couldn't stop crying the whole time. And I just feel really lucky to sort of like give a gift to trans people and like a love letter and just like a nod of recognition and appreciation. It feels incredibly moving to have that
forever, just to give folks something to hold on to at a time that's pretty upsetting in a lot of ways.
Well, Bree, I want to thank you so much for all the work that went into this film and for joining me today to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bree LaRose is a Milwaukee native and the co-writer of The People's Joker. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of a one-night-only screening of the film at the Cactus Club tomorrow evening. LaRose will be in attendance for the screening, and you can find more information at WUWM.com. When you travel, chances are you're using maps to find your way around. Charlie Sprinkman grew up in Milwaukee and currently calls Portland, Oregon, home. He's visited 41 of the 50 United States, and he'd often search for queer businesses and other safe places while on the road. That sparked the idea to create an interactive map to help people find queer-owned businesses no matter where they go. In January of 2022, he launched Everywhere is Queer. Since the launch, Everywhere is Queer has been viewed nearly 2 million times and now has over 9,000 registered queer-owned businesses around the world. Sprinkman spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last year.
Through all the travels, I was always seeking like queer spaces, obviously, and I just wanted something beyond queer bars. I mean, I do drink, but during the day, I would love to go to a coffee shop or like as I'm walking around a city, like don't necessarily need to be sitting in like a dark bar sometimes. but yeah, it was coming actually back summer of 2021. I was coming back from Brave Trails, which is a queer youth leadership camp. Which I was just at that camp. I was in a space of 100 plus queer folks. And it was so euphoric. And I was driving back to Boulder, Colorado at the time. And that's when Everywhere's Queer came to mind. I was like, a worldwide map of queer-owned businesses might be able to create community and support around queer-owned businesses and have this similar like euphoric experience. I wanted queer people and allies to experience that feeling. And so, yeah, the idea of a worldwide map of queer-owned businesses came to mind.
Well, and I love how this resource also makes people think differently about the ways that community can be built, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's my whole goal. I mean, when I launched this idea, I was like, there's many ways that this can go beautifully, but at the top of mind is local people finding community through these spaces on the map.
Yeah, outside of community, can you share more about the significance of a resource like this one? And especially I'm thinking about the deeper meaning it can give to the phrase safe travels, you know, for people who want to use it even outside of their own city.
Absolutely. I mean, just to say one thing, I've gotten hundreds and hundreds of DMs, but several that have said, hey, my partner and I now feel comfortable traveling across the United States, going on a long road trip that we would have never done before. So thank you for allowing us to plan a trip and map out all these spots so we can feel safe as we navigate across the country. But just outside of like the community aspect, as someone that grew up outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I wish I had a resource like this when I was a kid. And so I could just go sit at a queer-owned coffee shop and see queer people exist. Even when I was not out, I didn't come out until my junior year of college. But as just like a closeted queer kid or high school kid, I would have loved to have been able to go sit and once again, just see queer people exist, working, navigating through the world. I didn't have that as a kid.
And with the start of Everywhere's Queer, I'd love if you can take us back to kind of the beginning stages. You're pretty young considering a new business, but already there's been so much growth. There's over 2,000 businesses listed worldwide. So when you were first starting this, can you speak on those beginning stages? What are those early days of your business and networking look like and consist of?
I mean, everything that you see on Everywhere is Queer, Instagram, website, everything all designed by my colorblind self. So it's been a journey, like, you know, registering an LLC called Everywhere is Queer. It was a little bit of a journey. But the little things, I mean, I posted on Instagram January 2nd, and by March, I got picked up by NBC. And The Skim wrote an article on me, and now this posted a big post about me. So I got some PR hits a few months in, which was absolutely beautiful and accelerated the growth of Everywhere is Queer, definitely. But those first few months, I was very much just sitting by myself, trying to find queer-owned businesses to like message, to let them know that we exist and that like what we're building. And what I found is And it's so beautiful. It's really grown by word of mouth. I mean, social media as well. But I find that people hear of Everywhere is Queer and then they post it on their social media and it's like their community. And then it just keeps going from there, which is kind of how it all started. I mean, I posted on Instagram and then it just kind of kept rolling.
You know, we could look at the lens of, you know, at first Everywhere is Queer is also like an internal motivation. Like, I would have loved this as I was navigating and I want other people to have this. But outside of that motivation to for the community to have this resource, have you ever considered or pictured yourself as a founder?
I've kind of always been a little entrepreneur as a kid, you know, like in grade school, I was bedazzling pens and selling them for 25 cents, even though they took me hours to make. Clearly a sign that I might have been queer. I've just always been a little bit of an entrepreneur and I've always like kind of told myself, like, I would love to start my own business one day. I would love to work for myself. And yeah, I'm really grateful to say that I am full-time Everywhere is Queer now, which is obviously really scary. I'm not making millions of dollars or anything like that, but I'm taking this leap and I'm putting faith in myself. And every time I sign my email as founder and CEO, I feel so, you know, proud of myself.
So with starting this company and growing it by word of mouth, can you explain the process of how a queer-owned business gets on your map?
Yeah, thanks for asking. If you are a queer-owned business, you can visit www.everywhereisqueer.com. You can click any of the links in any of my social media channels, which is just Everywhere is Queer, Instagram, TikTok. So you'll land on my homepage and my website, which will then you'll see Form to Be on Map. It's a short application to apply to be on the map. And then a few days later, I will let you know when you've been added to the map.
I was exploring the map a little bit, and there's different categories you have for businesses. Can you explain some of those?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got retail, so like brick and mortar. So we welcome any like online stores. You do not have to be brick and mortar. You can just be, you know, out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You don't have to put your physical address. So if you have like an Etsy store or anything like that. So we have the category of online stores. We have real estate agents. We have therapists. I have a creative category, which is a lot of artists, tattoo artists. We have an outdoor recreation category. Yeah, there's 14 different categories. And it's so easy to just like filter by category wherever you are. Yeah.
And with connecting with queer business owners around the country, around the globe, whether you're doing that initial outreach or they're connecting with you, what's some of your favorite parts about connecting with these business owners?
You know, it's the passion and creativity. Also, just seeing the amount of inclusivity through all of these brands. Like, I keep landing on, obviously, queer-owned businesses' websites as I, like, check them out as they apply. And it's just incredible the amount of inclusivity in all of these brands. You know, it's, like, so much maybe not binary clothing categories. And just, like, really thinking about how everyone can be seen in the picture, not just queer people and allies, but no matter who you are or what your body looks like, there's so many brands out there that are ready to see you for you, no matter who you are. And I think that's just like such a beautiful thing. And I get really inspired by so many of these businesses.
In addition to the businesses you're interacting with, there's of course the people out there using this resource. So what are some encounters, maybe digital or otherwise, that stand out to you and have kind of reaffirmed and continue to reaffirm your mission with Everywhere is Queer?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I've gotten so many messages that have made my little queer heart cry in the best possible way. But one message is, I got one from a small town in Europe, in Latvia, which is a country, but small city in Latvia. And this human said, you know, I can't be out and proud to be queer in my city as it's very dangerous. But knowing that the day that I can leave my city and move somewhere else, I see all the pins on your map and it's just giving me life to know. And it's making me so excited to experience life as an out queer person. So it's things like, and messages like that. I've gotten messages that people have found, you know, gender affirming healthcare provider in their city that they didn't know existed via my map. I once again had so many people message me and be like, we're so excited to plan our road trip from here to here. And like I said, we would have never done it. And all things to your map. We're now hitting the road. And it's messages like that that keep me alive. And also hearing that, like, a therapist has found 5 new clients. I just got a message about that because people found them on the therapist on our map is such a beautiful thing to me.
Yeah, those stories and all the pins on the map is certainly a great sight to see. And Charlie, I want to thank you so much for joining me today to share more about Everywhere is Queer.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Charlie Sprinkman is the founder and CEO of Everywhere is Queer. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski last June. To explore the map for yourself, head to WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how a local laboratory is working to better understand and treat sickle cell disease. Plus, we'll have a sneak peek at episode 2 of our new podcast, Swing State of the Union. This episode explores how the urban-rural divide plays into politics. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.